Before we get into the conversation, here's a little bit of information about how this podcast series came about.
Hello, my name is Cizizo, and I'm the curator in residence at City Arts and the producer of Catalyst, a programme that has been designed in response to City Arts Black Lives Matter commitments and a series of conversations that followed. Looking back at the conversations, the group discussed events that followed the tragic murder of George Floyd and the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement. They also spoke about navigating the arts, their own practices, and their vision for anti-racism within the sector. One particular discussion that took place was one in which the group spoke about the people who had inspired them, both personally and professionally. And so I wanted to produce a series in which some of my favourite creatives from Nottingham could do just that for listeners, particularly for aspiring creatives of African Caribbean heritage. I also wanted the series to give an insight into the journey of some of these creatives, for them to be able to share their experiences about some of the wins, about some of the losses, and the things that drive their practices. Whilst it's also important to speak about racism, and we do cover that within the series, it was also important to give space for discussion outside of it. The experiences of Black people are not monolithic, and our identities are much more than the struggles and suffering of racism. The conversations will explore the guests' creative processes, the 2020 anti-racism protests, and mental health. The podcasts will also look at entrepreneurship and the guests' experiences of navigating the pandemic. Community Conversations is hosted by Rachel Wilcox. Rachel is arts editor at Left Lion, a Nottingham-based cultural magazine, and contributing writer for Black Ballad, a UK-based lifestyle platform that seeks to tell the human experience through the eyes of Black British women. Alongside writing, Rachel has a wealth of volunteer experience within the cultural sector. She currently works as arts marketer at New Art Exchange. Thank you so much for listening into Community Conversations. We hope you enjoy the episode. The conversation that you're about to listen to was recorded on location at City Arts on the 16th of December 2020. The relevant guidelines regarding social distancing at the time were followed.
Hello, thanks for listening. My name is Rachel and you're listening to the City Arts Community Conversations podcast. In this episode, I chat with Norma Gregory, a former English teacher turned historian, broadcaster, heritage consultant, and arts curator. She is committed to rewriting a history that makes sense for everyone. Her focus is on preserving and embedding African Caribbean history within the mainstream. Her curiosity to discover sideline stories and her passion for the arts has seen her through many different creative projects as well as life challenges. She talks about how it was a necessity to create the work she has done, how books saved her life, and how exploring her story and looking within led to a wider interest in history. Norma started by telling us about her creative journey, which is proof that we don't always start where we're supposed to end up.
I actually think we've all got a place in the world, meaning we've all got something to contribute to this world, to make the world a better place. Literally, it's a bit of a cliche, but we've all got a role to play. And yeah, I think it can take a while for you to see your role, but it will come in some way. It will come to you. Mine came because I was off teaching. Mm. I was at home unwell, and I had time to think. And you can't always do what people want you to do or what your parents want you to do. Because your parents, as a West Indian child, they always want you to be often a teacher, a doctor, or a nurse. Having not done very well at school in Nottingham, I was kind of put in bottom classes for English and maths. And I liked writing and I liked reading, but I was just like considered not to be a good writer. So, you know, you put in CSE, which is we had O-levels and CSE when I was at school. So, I just remember drawing a lot in my English lessons. So I went back to college when I was 20, 21, evening class. And then I left my job to go back to college full time to study journalism and English and French. And then after that, I wrote to Hackney Council to ask them to pay for me to go to university, which they did in 94 to 96 I was at college, and then 96 to 99, 3 years at St Mary's in Twickenham, studying English and theology. Wow. So that was part of my kind of re-education. I found that, I mean, obviously I didn't really get everything what I wanted from those studies. I loved my time at St Mary's, that was amazing. But I was always asking questions, and some of the books I had to read, I was always having to read double, read around the text we were given to read, because I was always questioning, looking at particular, the portrayal of particular characters in novels. There was racism in text, there was sexism in text in a lot of the books we were reading. So I was having to do a lot of theoretical studies and philosophical, you know, you kind of go into different areas to try to make sense of what's put in front of you. And also my own understanding of being a Black African person in Britain, understanding my situation, place, who I was, you know, why is it I'm having to restudy everything again? Why didn't I learn this at school? You know, was the biggest thing that I was kind of battling with. So university helped me to kind of answer some of those questions, not all of those questions, but some of them. And then I went on from there. I love books. They literally saved my life. I did actually spend a year in a women's refuge when I was 19 in Hackney. And it was a book that saved my life. Books I just literally read when I was in my room by myself. And that was my kind of like major turning point when I was 19, 20. I love to read biographies and autobiographies, people's life journey, life stories.
Yeah.
And I just really like to understand who they were, like their context, their position in life, and knowing that. I just wanted to see what happened to you. You know, it's that question, like, who are you? Like, what happened to you? And I like that. I like to find out what happened to people, you know, in their life. And knowing about other people's lives, you just realise how blessed you are with your life, even though you might not think you've got anything special or going on, or you're kind of useless at whatever. But you're not. You're actually blessed with lots of talent, you know what I mean? So learning about other people's life story helped me to think, I wasn't so bad after all, or what's happening to me has happened to other people as well. And they've survived to tell the tale or help other people.
And we also spoke about the dangers of not talking about the past in Black Caribbean families.
My journey with Black history just starts off with me, my own kind of desire and need to understand who I was, why am I here, why was I like going to primary school and I was the only Black child in my class. I just wanted to understand, I just wanted to think there were silences, particularly at home. My parents really didn't talk that much about their past. And we weren't really encouraged to ask questions.
I don't know if that's something in the Caribbean community, but I think that that's quite common sometimes.
But it's not good. It's not healthy.
No.
Because you grow up thinking, why aren't we talking about this? Or why don't I know my grandparents very well? Or where are they? And it's all kind of questions. All kinds of questions I was asking in my own head that weren't being answered. So my journey with Black history really started with my desire to know more about my kind of context, like my place in the world and my forefathers, you know, like things like slavery being brought up and like, what, you know, we weren't, I had to work it all out.
Yeah.
And we were just being linked to certain negative things. And also, you know, back to schooling again, feeling the odd face. I went to school, there was only a few black people in the primary school, a few in my secondary school as well. So
must have been challenging.
Yeah, it was. Well, I got through it. I survived. But I just thought I needed to know more. And I just thought, I'm not being told anything. So I thought, right, I need to do my own research and my own reading, my own kind of, personal learning, really, again, re-educating myself.
Norma's book, Jamaicans in Nottingham, is a collection of personal and reflective interviews and articles from individuals of Jamaican heritage who have contributed to the spirit and life of the city. I asked her how it all came about.
That book just came about because I thought, you know, I'm a trained journalist. I need to do something to help the community in Nottingham. I saw our elders passing away. I used to go to the Afro-Caribbean Centre, the ACNA Centre in St. Anne's. I still go there, you know, now, even though it's closed, but I'm still like a member. But my parents were part of were members there for years. So I thought, you know, I'm a trained teacher, I'm a trained journalist, use those skills. I couldn't have gone to university and be trained in all this, you know, all these skills and not help part of the educational system. Because I think when I was teaching, I just noticed I didn't like some of the books I was being asked to talk. And I always thought, you know, could I do better? Could I do, you know, what can I do? So the books that I did, it was just part of my way of contributing to knowledge, contributing to publishing, not complaining, because I always think you need to complain and speak up, but I always think you should be part of the solution, in that if you can help do something to make this world a better place, whatever it is, you need to do it. You know, do it. Would you do it without, if it's something you would do without pay? It's something that you need to be paid for your work, but sometimes you have to do things because you want to do them and because they're important, yeah. Regardless of money. Yeah. So I was doing things, you know, regardless of money, just doing it because they needed to be done. The money comes down the line later, but first, as an artist, you need to follow your passion and you need to do what needs to be done.
We also spoke about her work on the Digging Deep project.
So Digging Deep is really the name of a project all around preserving the history, the life stories of former coal miners of African heritage, African Caribbean heritage, who worked in coal mines in the UK. So, I mean, how this came about, I mean, it came about really from the book I was doing, Jamaicans in Nottingham. I wrote two of the chapters about black miners, coal miners. And then I met a historian who, you know, he said, you know, what else do you know about black miners? And I said, nothing really. And he said, you know, why don't you look into it a bit more? So I thought, okay, I will. All right, I will do that. So I started to interview people in the area, just say, you know, I'm looking for miners. Do you know many miners? And then I started at the ACNA Centre, the Afro-Caribbean Centre in St. Anne's. I started there because that's where a lot of the elders went in the community from the Caribbean. That's the social club. So I started asking questions there and asked my parents if they knew anyone. So I started to get names, and then I realised I had a miner in my family as well. I interviewed him for my book, and then he spoke about working at the pit. And I said to him, you know, what do you mean working at the pit? And he says, you know, I was a miner. I was like, I said, you know, you've never spoke about that before. Coming to our house, growing up with this relative, a cousin, my dad's first cousin, he never spoke about the fact that he was a miner. And I said, you know, tell me about it. So I literally just put my recorder on, my recorder, and just sat with him and listened to his experience of working as a coal miner in the UK. So that was the starting point, and it just grew. The project just grew. I've now interviewed close to 70 70 odd minors and about 20 people who had minors in their family or worked with the colleagues of minors all over the country, from Wales. I've been up to Durham, Yorkshire. I've got minors in Kent now that I need to speak to in the new year. It's just been incredible. We've been able to make television programmes. We made the Wales Black Miners BBC programme. That was incredible, helping with the research for that and being a consultant on that programme and featuring in the programme as a historian. And I've done so much work with the BBC. I'm working with them now to help create new teaching material for BBC Bite Size and BBC Teach. And then working on all sorts of projects. There's a film being made. I mean, it's just been incredible, the kind of offshoots. And the exhibition as well, which is called Digging Deep, that we've been able to tour for the last 2 years. It's been on tour. It started in Nottingham at the New Art Exchange. We showed there some of the content that we had in 2018. And then it's just been on tour. We had 6 months at the National Coal Mining Museum in Wakefield. Originally, we were supposed to have been there 3 months, extended to 6 months. And then we were up at Museum Northumberland it's a mining museum in Woodhorn Mining Museum in Northumberland. We were just showing there in October and November. We were on an exhibition there. And that exhibition was a collection of art that we've managed to showcase and put together and collate. Basically, we've had paintings done by Honey Williams. She's one of the artists that did worked with our volunteers to help create a painting. We've had photography done by David Seven of portraits of the miners. We've had costumes donated by the public that they wore coming to England in the 50s. We've had poetry written about black miners' experience. We've had we've bought artifacts, lamps, helmets, boots. I mean, it's been surreal, but we just brought it all together to show people, the public, the experience of miners, the hard work of all miners in this country. They have yet to be formally thanked by the government. That's something that I'm passionate about. They are still having issues with their pensions now, the miners' pensions. They're supposed to get more pension than what they're getting. That's an issue. You know, a lot of the miners are unwell at the moment. They've got chest problems. Obviously, coronavirus. Some have died during this period. So for me, it's about their recognizing their contribution. Workers, people who've worked in this country, the miners are one group of people that have worked in this country, miners of all colours, but the miners of African Caribbean heritage were not formally recognised nor mentioned in books, mentioned in artwork. I just said, where are they? They're around. There are many. I've spoken to them. Why aren't they featured in any programmes or in any books or in photography? So I said, right, I've got to do something about that. And I said, right, let's start. And I'm still on the journey with it all. But we've been able to create a lot of content now for television. I'm just finishing writing the book, the Black Miners book.
I have to say, when I was researching it, I kind of got a bit lost in how much it's expanded and really took off.
It's been amazing, and it's been embraced by the public. You know, that's been key. We've been able to lead new artworks, new theatre productions. We had Bally Black, the big ballet company that in London, they did a production, was it last year in Nottingham?
Nottingham Playhouse.
Yes, the Playhouse. Yes. And they had and part of the play was about miners in South Africa.
Yeah.
So I said, I wanted to stand up and jump because I was like, we've inspired them to do that. I kind of said, if it wasn't for all the work, the Guardian newspaper as well, they were instrumental in actually bringing the story to light some years back now. So, and Channel 4, we did a piece of Channel 4 News, which was a big story the week. A couple of days before Amber Rudd resigned over the Windrush scandal, right. You know, the miners spoke about that on Channel 4 News, and then she resigned the Sunday. We were on the news on the Friday, it was either 27th or 28th of April 2018. And she resigned that weekend because of the Windrush scandal. But they did speak about the fact that they weren't being, why is it like this? You know, why is it our elders in the community are being discriminated against, you know? And it's Jamaican community. It's just the Jamaican community as far as I'm concerned. It's other countries, but it's mainly the Jamaican community who are being victimized by.
Is that out of the Caribbean community?
Yeah,
right.
Mainly Jamaicans. The Windrush scandal, it's been a lot of Jamaicans who have been, but not just Jamaicans, been other countries as well, but a lot of Jamaicans, yeah. Even the flight that they tried to deport last week? They tried to deport 50 Jamaicans.
Yes.
50 Jamaicans. That message is wrong. That message is wrong. I mean, they ended up deporting, I think it's 13 in the end, but there's been this deliberate focus on trying to disrupt and destroy sections of our community.
Yeah, you know.
And it was wrong because the British history in the Caribbean is quite a disgusting and disturbing story.
Definitely.
The narrative of that. And that's the last thing they should be doing is picking on any of our people, actually. You know, they should be thanking those people in a big way instead of trying to rob them of their lives, livelihoods, dignity.
Definitely.
And she shared her experiences of being a black teacher in Britain.
Being a black teacher, black female teacher, you know, the system is made... the system's made quite difficult for you to exist in that environment. It's a real toxic environment. It's quite harsh, but it is. To be a black teacher in Britain, it's you need a medal for that. You're kind of judged a lot, and that was hard. And no matter how hard you worked and worked late at night and stayed for the parents' evening till 9 o'clock at night, it wasn't enough. At the end of my teaching career, I felt... unwell. I felt depressed, actually,
right.
And I just felt this can't be, there must be something else. So I was unwell from work, and I took time off, and they were understanding for me taking the time off. I felt totally guilty when I was off as well, because I was worried about the pupils and their work, their coursework and their essays and all the marking I had to do, I had to catch up on if I went back and everything. I was stressed. But I just found myself in that time off, and I said, I started to write little articles because I've trained in journalism. And then I thought, I'm going to make my own little magazine. So I started to just put a little booklet together. And then I looked for a writing course, and I discovered, I don't know how I discovered it, but there was a writing group right in my area where I lived, and I thought, right, I called the lady and I said, you know, can I come to this group? And it was good in the, I didn't really say anything at the beginning because I didn't really want to tell people why I was there and what I was doing there. I just wanted them to accept me and allow me to just be part of the group, because I needed that kind of, I wanted to be in a creative circle. I wanted to be part of a group where people were writing and doing their thing, because I knew I could write, but I didn't want to kind of go in there and start acting as if I knew everything. I just wanted to listen and learn from people who were trying to be writers, you know. We were all there for different reasons. Nobody asked anybody about their background, like, you know, why they were there, because I felt even guilty being there, but I needed that as part of my own development and therapy at the time.
After the murder of George Floyd in 2020, racism was brought to the forefront.
That was brought to my attention really by my daughter. She's online a lot, and that video, you know, she saw that before me, and all her friends saw that before me, and Because I don't spend as much time, you know, on social media. I do some of the time, but I'm doing my work and things. So I don't kind of watch, you know, I don't get distracted too much. But that was brought to my attention by her, and she was just horrified. And her friends and her school friends were just shocked and horrified by it all. And it was disturbing to see. I mean, for me at my age, I mean, I have seen things like that many times, you know what I mean? I've heard, you know, there's been many a black murder in the UK. For many years, I've seen all through my life growing up. So it wasn't, it was almost like I was really shocked. I was shocked that, the reason why that was so big, it was that everybody saw it. It was like, it was something that the whole world saw for the first time. But this has been happening many a time before that, and nobody was, you know, things were just being brushed on the carpet. Things were happening and the police were allowing it to continue. Mm. But because the white community saw it online, young people, I think that was what was different about this.
Mm.
And it was so casual. It was so blatant. It was filmed. We had the police standing watching it in the middle of the street in America. This was shocking, disturbing, beyond anything I'd kind of experienced. And then the demonstrations, my daughter said, you know, she was quite active and she was kind of, she said, no, she's going part of the demonstration. I was really worried. I was worried for her. I was worried for her friends. I was worried for, because what it brought back to me was the miners' strikes and the police brutality used against the miners, particularly the Orgreave case in 1984, when the police were on horseback and they literally battered the miners. It was a public kind of war. And that kept flashing in my mind, thinking, are these young people demonstrating going to be confronted with police with batons on horseback, all that? I had terrible dreams and nightmares. Mm-hmm.
And I guess as a mother in that period as well,
right?
And feeling like, you know, protective of a child. Yes, it must have been quite hard.
It was. I was crying. I really said. I said to her, "You're not going. Please don't go." I didn't want her to go. Mm-hmm. I knew she had to go because her spirit was calling her.
Mm-hmm.
But part of me was crying inside and crying outside as well, because I just feared what was going to happen, because I knew a lot of young people were protesting about this. And the young people were saying, no, we're not having this, you know, and I was so proud of them. So I actually went. I didn't want to go to the demonstration. I didn't want to go to the forest, but my spirit said, you are going to there. Because I said to myself, I am going to die on that forest. I will die that day. I have to be there that day because I am a witness to what's going to happen on that grass. I need to be there to photograph. I was taking pictures, videoing bits. There was loads of people taking pictures of things, but I said I had to be there because if anything happens to the young people, if anything happens to the people of Nottingham, if anything happens to my daughter, I said I had to be there. I can't be at home and knowing that she's in danger or the police on horseback or anything, you know. Luckily, there was no police on horseback. There was undercover police there. Uh-huh. There was a lot of police there.
Yeah.
But I said I had to be there because if that's where I'm going to die, I'm going to die there today.
Yeah.
I faced, and luckily, it was a very, very peaceful, well-managed. There were thousands of people there. And it had to be done, and I do thank the organisers for that, for the young women that fronted that. I really respect them for being brave. Well, these demonstrations happened across the world, you know, so it wasn't just, this was the world saying this is not acceptable, you know. And why does it take the world to know that, to say that.
And here in the UK, we've questioned whether enough is taught about Black history and British colonialism.
I think it's got to be tackled from different levels. And for instance, I think the curriculum, the school curriculum, it's got to be scrapped. But the history, the teaching of history, I don't even think it should be a choice. I think it should be almost like a compulsory subject.
Yeah.
I definitely think the colonial history, it should be tackled from that angle as well, because like you say, it involves, I don't know, over 100, I think, countries involved, Britain's links with colonialism and imperialism. It stretches far across this globe. I mean, many people of English heritage, they kind of celebrate that. I think it's a real, I think it's quite shocking and really quite disturbing.
Mm.
The destruction of life and destruction of civilizations and communities and cultures across the world.
Mm.
Dangerous, shocking, disturbing, but yeah, and that's British history.
Mm.
It's not the Henry VIII that we need to know about. And actually, Henry VIII's history is quite disturbing. If you actually know about Henry VIII, which I've been doing a lot of studying and watching a lot of programs about Henry VIII's legacy, what the problems that he caused, and his treatment of women. So yeah, the colonial story is a compulsory story for education, the world history, and particularly British history. We need to include Welsh history and Scottish history. I know very little. Only recently, obviously since doing the black mining history, have I learned a bit about Wales.
Mm.
I didn't know anything about Wales. I've never been to Wales.
Mm.
You know, I can't, I should know how to say hello, thank you, goodbye in Welsh.
Mm.
Why not? Why haven't I been introduced to that in my education in England? That's a problem, because the Welsh people have also been forced to learn English, and their history is, you know, they're fighting for their, to keep their language, and rightly so, keeping their history, rightly so. Scottish as well, you know, the Scottish history has been decimated, and, you know, the English in Scotland is quite shocking if you actually look at what's happened there, and we're not taught about that, and Ireland as well, you know. So I think that needs to be rewritten and I think it needs to be told in a truthful manner.
Mm.
And it takes bravery for this country to say, look, we've got to look at this and change, you know. But it's easy to keep churning out what they churn out at school. And what they churn out in schools, a lot of young people have turned away from history, the subject of history as a they don't choose it as a degree or as a GCSE, not many. Only certain pupils do.
Mm.
You know, often white male boys will choose it. Why do that group want to learn that stuff? Why?
Mm.
Because it's told in their favour. It's told to strengthen them and to improve their kind of mental health, well-being.
Mm.
That's an issue for me.
Mm.
It cuts out
like
girls,
you
know, cuts out ethnic minorities. It cuts out, you know, I should know about Chinese history. I don't, you know, we don't know about that. We don't know about Asian history, you know what I mean?
Mm.
We don't know enough,
mm-hmm.
you know. And the Britain's involvement in India, in Pakistan, you know, it's quite shocking
yeah.
and disturbing,
yeah.
you know.
I was going to say, do you think that art can help to teach that history?
It can.
In a different and
yeah.
a more inventive and an alternative way.
Yeah, it can. It is a good kind of tool for readdressing, reinterpreting the human experience, most definitely. Yeah, because people can relate to art more than they can relate to a book sometimes. Yeah, I mean, a book is art, I think. Literature is art
yeah.
form. But I think as an artist, and I do consider myself to be an artist, in that an artist creates things, and an artist presents things, presents the human condition. Yeah, I think art can be used to educate, most definitely. Mm. Yeah. Yes. So, I mean, back to the question of Black history, definitely should, I mean, whether it should be an independent subject, I'm not sure if it should be independent, like GCSE, for instance, but I think it should be offered. It should be on offer. If students wish to choose that subject, it should be there, made available for them to do, like projects, to do independent research and add it to their GCSE history. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It should be made available, and it should be made available that students can seek knowledge outside of the school. Independent study, independent inquiry. They should be allowed out to do some interviews with the public, or to write a chapter of a book, or to write a children's book and put it towards their GCSE history. Because it's their understanding, it's their knowledge, you know, it's their learning. You can't just keep churning out stuff. You know, when I say stuff, I mean stuff that's in books, and, you know, what we are taught about Queen Victoria, about, you know, monarchs. You can't keep churning that stuff out and thinking that people are going to be happy with that. Mm. And it's relevant. It's not relevant. It's part of our history. Mm. But and it is our history. I use that pronoun, ours, because it's part of my history. And just like African history is part of other people's history, and Chinese history or whatever. It's our history. It's a shared history. And we don't own it. Certain groups do not own that bit, or don't. They should. It shouldn't be, you know. It should be, you know, because I'm a Black woman, you know, I'm the only person who can study Black history. No, I don't think so. I think it's about understanding people's experience and their context and their time in history and what happened to them in that time and how it compares to our experience now, because there are links. There are links. Henry VIII, he does have a link to me in that his treatment of women. You know, I'm a woman, so I can understand, I can see how he, you know, how some men treat women. You know, I've also, you know, had experiences that I can relate to some of that. We are all connected through different ways, you know what I mean? And I think it's celebrating that, and also understanding how we are connected, and also respecting other people's experience, or, you know, and celebrating your kind of relationship with the world and with other groups,
yeah.
You know, whatever groups you're linked to. We are the story, we are the narrative. What we are doing now, it forms the history of the future.
Finally, we asked Norma what she wished she had known at the start of her career.
Yeah, I mean, three things I would say is definitely follow your own intuition and your own spirit. Follow what you want to do. And don't be blinded by parents, brothers and sisters, employers, your boss, your partner, boyfriend, girlfriend, whoever. Do not allow them, because you will become something that you're not, and you will find yourself wasting time and having to come back to what you originally were thinking in the first place. So it's almost like trust yourself. That's the first one. Number two, I would say, don't be afraid to stand alone when you need to. And that could be if you need a space, a quiet space, take that space. You know, if you're in a noisy group, you're going to have to say to that group, either you need to be quiet or I'm moving myself to somewhere quiet. You know, it might be your own bedroom, or it might be a room in the house, or it might be going to the library or going to the gym or whatever. But take that space, your own private space, to be, to think, to chill out. But have that space in the day, and don't let, again, anyone take that away from you, because you're entitled in 24 hours to have some private time to be. Yes, that's number two. And number three, is to share and be kind. Number four is be kind, but number three is to share what you find with others, good or bad. You know, share things that you learn along the way. in whatever form you wish it to be. It could be through music, it could be through poetry, it could be through design, it could be through architecture. That's all ways of sharing skills, sharing beauty, sharing science, you know what I mean? Whatever it is, I think that's something, you know, I wish I'd learned to kind of embrace those three things early in my life. And I think I would have been a different person now, but those are three things I would really encourage people to do.
Thanks to Norma Gregory for taking the time to come and have a chat with us and share her experiences with us. And thank you to the listeners for tuning in. Until the next episode, goodbye.